You know, the word is spreading around America. This is the go-to place if you've got a prayer and you want the whole country praying for it. So I invite people to join us every night for the Family Rosary Across America Live.
7 p.m. Central.
Bringing Christ to the world through the media.
Relevant Radio.
This presentation has been previously broadcast.
And that no taxpayer should ever be forced to pay for abortion. Abortion is not health care. It is murder. I will not stand by quiet. I say Planned Parenthood can go fund themselves. Mr. Speaker, I ask unanimous consent that the committees on Energy and Commerce, Ways and Means, and the Judiciary be discharged from further consideration of H.R. 18, No Taxpayer Funding for Abortion Act, and ask for immediate consideration in the House.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back and good afternoon. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew today, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. The voice you heard was Representative Lauren Boebert, Republican from Colorado, on the House floor, talking about the appropriation for Medicare that is being pushed without the Hyde Amendment, the first time in decades that the funding bill has not included the prohibition of using the funds in that bill for abortions. And joining me right now to talk about the implications of that is Michael New, an associate scholar at the Charlotte Lozier Institute and a research associate at the Bush School at the Catholic University of America. You can follow him on Twitter at Michael_J_New. And Michael, welcome back. Always great to talk to you.
Oh, thanks for having me. Much appreciated.
You know, I have been surprised over the last 5 years about the opposition to the Hyde Amendment. Now, this, I'm not surprised that some Democrats talk about it. I'm not surprised that, you know, a few of them would push to eliminate it. But the Hyde Amendment is actually a very popular provision that acts to keep from taxpayer dollars going to fund abortion. And we can actually argue, by the way, that because money is fungible, the money that goes to Planned Parenthood through Title X programs is probably funding abortions anyway, but at least you had that prohibition that was very popular. And over the last 5 years, Democrats have really declared war on this. And Republicans have been trying very hard to keep it in place. And right now it looks like Democrats are going to try to push through the Medicare funding plan without it. That can they succeed at it, I guess, is the first question I have, Michael.
That's a good question. I mean, pro-lifers have our work cut out for us. They did succeed in getting the House to pass an appropriations bill that did not include the Hyde Amendment that passed yesterday. The vote was 219-208. It was a party-line vote. Every Democrat congressman who voted in favor of this. Every Republican congressman who voted against it. So now it goes to the Senate, and the Senate's going to pass their own appropriations bill that would fund Medicaid. And I think we have a chance to win in the Senate. Senator Joe Manchin, who's a Democrat from West Virginia, has said that he would support Hyde in every way possible. He co-authored a letter with Senator Roger Wicker, a Republican senator from Mississippi, in support of the Hyde Amendment. So they need Manchin's vote if they want to pass an appropriations bill that does not include Hyde, and it does not appear they have it. That said, there's the old saying, trust but verify. Manchin votes the way we want him to sometimes, but not always. So, again, people really need to make their voice heard. I'd recommend that all your listeners, call your U.S. senator. Even if you live in a blue state with a senator who supports legal abortion, senators want to win re-election. And if enough constituents call, they will pay attention. So this is still winnable for us, but we certainly have our work cut out for us.
Well, and I get back to the point of even taxpayers who might say that, well, abortion is a personal choice for somebody, and I don't want to interfere with it. It's sort of like the old Joe Biden position, right? Well, I'm personally opposed to abortion, but I don't want to interfere with somebody's choice. I don't think my religion belongs in public law, whatever, et cetera. The old Joe Biden position. Most of those taxpayers would say, but I don't want to fund it. I don't think that the government should be funding it. If it's a personal choice, then the person who's making that choice should fund their own abortions. That was Joe Biden's position up until I'm not sure exactly when that change was, but I would say By last year, it had definitely changed. He started talking about that during the 2019, really. He started talking about supporting the removal of the Hyde Amendment, or opposing the Hyde Amendment. Maybe even during the Obama administration, although I can't really recall for sure what his position was there. But I mean, he's drifted to the left on this in a very significant way, and it really does seem like that position has been radicalized. And I generally don't like to get into, well, Democrats this and Republicans that, especially on this platform. But in this case, there's no other real way to describe it. That's the only context in which this is happening.
You're right. I mean, Joe Biden changed his position in 2019 as a presidential candidate. When he was a U.S. senator, he supported the Hyde Amendment. We uncovered a letter he wrote to a constituent back in 1994 where he bragged that on no fewer than 50 occasions did he vote against taxpayer funding for abortion. So Joe Biden, like a lot of Democrats, you support the Hyde Amendment. In fact, 107 Democrats, House Democrats, vote for the original Hyde Amendment back in 1976. The Hyde Amendment was in 7 of the 8 budgets that President Clinton proposed. The Hyde Amendment was in all 8 budgets that President Obama proposed. So we went from 107 House Democrats voting for Hyde back in 1976 to 0 yesterday. So the Democratic Party really has shifted to the left on this issue. They not only think abortion should be legal, they think it should be paid for with their taxpayer dollars. So that's just tragic that an amendment that enjoyed such bipartisan support is only really getting support from Republicans these days.
And I'm trying to find the polling on this. I don't have it in front of me yet. But the polling among voters for the Hyde Amendment is bipartisan and strong. I mean, the support for the Hyde Amendment is not a partisan issue among voters. Certainly, if you're getting into there's certainly a very clear and fairly balanced split on the issue of abortion itself, but not on the Hyde Amendment. It's very popular. So why isn't that being reflected in Congress as it stands today? And by the way, again, we're talking with Michael New from the Charlotte Lozier Institute and taking your calls on this at 888-914-9149. Michael, why isn't Congress reflecting the consensus, if you will, on this?
You're certainly right. The Hyde Amendment is popular. That I did a little bit of research on some of the polling, and I came up with 11 national polls taken since 2016. In all 11, a plurality opposed taxpayer funding of abortion, and in 10 of the 11, majority opposed taxpayer funding for abortion. So this is popular. So why are Democrats running away from a popular issue? I just think it has a lot to do with some of the changing demographics within the Democratic Party. That at one point, a key constituency for Democrats were a lot of kind of older Catholic voters who came of age during the Great Depression or World War II. And these voters were somewhat liberal on economic issues. They supported unions. They supported programs like Medicare and Medicaid. But they were socially conservative. And voting against tax-free funding for abortion was a good way to reach out to those voters. That generation of Democrats, that more conservative generation of Democrats, has kind of passed away. If somebody was 10 when the Great Depression happened, they're over 100 now. So this older conservative generation has been kind of replaced with a younger generation that's a lot more liberal, a lot more secular, a lot more supportive of legal abortion. And I think a lot of these Democrats are just responding to the sort of people who vote in Democratic primaries, which aren't really representative of the country as a whole.
I think that there's a larger issue here that we're talking about, too, when we're talking about this, which is that there's been sort of a deconstruction of the Catholic vote over that same period of time, right? I mean, the Catholic vote used to be a distinct Catholic vote. It was working class. It was, sort of Rust Belt-ish. It was suburban slash, you know, first ring suburban, you know, slash urban. And it had a particular point of view, right? The Catholic vote had a particular point of view. And both the Democrats and Republicans had some of that, but Democrats actually did very well among Catholics. You know, union workers would be another component of this. But that sort of has disintegrated, and the Catholic vote now is usually, not always, but usually more or less an echo of the overall popular vote in any election. It usually isn't all that distinct, and that might be part of what the problem is here.
No, I agree that a lot of Catholics identified with the Democratic Party historically. A lot of my older relatives, even though they were very pro-life, they were registered Democrats. And that's changed. I think that with the Democratic Party moving to the left on a lot of issues involving life, involving marriage, that's changed. And you actually see kind of a little bit of a different split now. You look at Catholics who attend church somewhat infrequently. That's a demographic that votes Democrat. But if you look at those Catholics who attend Mass on a weekly basis, that's a demographic that's trending a lot more Republican lately. So you really see as the Democratic Party has become a lot more vocal and a lot more active in their support for legal abortion, they're getting less and less support from church-going Catholics.
Yeah, I think that's a good point that you make there, too. And I would say that the nature of the political parties here in the United States have changed, too. Both parties. They have become a lot more ideological. Both parties have become a lot more ideological. And I think that has a lot to do with the access to mass communication, sort of the democratization, small d democratization, of access to mass communication, is that it becomes a lot more easy to aggregate among ideological lines than, say, the sort of the regional cultural lines that we had in prior decades, right? When the Hyde Amendment was first proposed in 1976, you know, the Democratic, you had, you know, Blue Dog Democrats that were conservative Democrats, primarily from the South. You had, you know, Rockefeller Republicans, liberal Republicans are primarily from the Northeast. The Western Democrats and Republicans tended to be a little bit more libertarian in, certainly libertarian tinged, let's say. I mean, Ronald Reagan really kind of came out of a conservo-libertarian sort of mold in California that doesn't exist at all anymore out there. I think some of this, I think the Hyde Amendment is becoming sort of a victim of this ideological realignment of both parties, where it has become, even though voters, it's very popular and it's got a broad bipartisan support among voters, the parties simply are looking for things to differ on. And this is one of the big, huge points of difference, abortion, and it's sort of a branding issue for Democrats, I think. And I think that's one reason why you saw Hillary Clinton come out in 2016 and really make that a banner issue in the presidential campaign, and then Joe Biden sort of backed into doing the exact same thing in 2020.
No, I agree with you. I think what you kind of see happening is that especially a lot of younger voters are kind of casting votes that are a lot more consistent with, say, their ideology than, say, older voters. You know, a lot of people come of age with a certain political party, and they're just reluctant to leave. You know, there's a lot of older folks who, you know, are pro-life and don't like the Democratic Party's position on abortion, but that was a party they grew up with. Sometimes they were taught that was a proper way to vote, so they're just less inclined to leave, and they keep voting Democrat. Younger people, you know, don't really have that history. You know, they wake up, they see the two parties debating the issues on TV, and they just sort of pick the party that they're most sympathetic to on issues. So, you know, I agree. I do think that the, you know, Hyde may be a victim of this kind of ongoing polarization. I think that, again, it's just tough to believe that, you know, we had 219 Democrats vote for an appropriations bill that did not include the Hyde Amendment, and we couldn't peel off any of those Democrats. I mean, some of these Democrats do represent moderate conservative districts. They're casting a vote that I think was politically unwise. I think that that needs to be a big campaign issue in 2022 and beyond. So, you know, I do think if this hurts them politically, they may step back a bit. But I think you are right. The Hyde Amendment may well be a victim of just the increasing polarization in American politics.
And it certainly sets up an interesting context for the Supreme Court fight that's coming up. We just got done talking with Ed Whalen at EPPC and National Review's Bench Memos about the Dobbs case that the Supreme Court took regarding the 15-week abortion limit in Mississippi. And this is the first case that it's the first case in a long time, I should say, that really is taking aim at Roe, direct aim at Roe. And this is something that, you know, John Roberts suggested was missing from an earlier case, and it's the reason why they didn't take it up. So bluff called, they're going to be taking it up now. And I do think it's really going to be sort of an interesting background for this. In the meantime, though, you mentioned the Senate. Obviously, the Senate's got to put together its own funding package there, and they can't get that package through the Senate. The Medicaid package is still going to be, I believe, is it still subject to the filibuster? Because I'm trying to remember now whether or not budget items are subject to the filibuster.
An appropriations bill can be filibustered. If it's something right. called reconciliation, which involves changing tax law, that cannot be filibustered. Right. That can get through with a bare majority, but I'm pretty sure the appropriations bill can be filibustered.
I believe you're correct.
Again,
yes.
That could be a way to kind of restore Hyde funding. And again, if we just flip one Democrat, that could be Joe Manchin. The Senate can approve an appropriations bill, and that does include Hyde.
Well, I mean, if you flip, you don't need to flip Manchin just to stop an to conduct the filibuster, but if you can flip Manchin mm-hmm. on it, then they can't even pass it under reconciliation. There's a whole other context for this in terms of the infrastructure bill that's currently being negotiated. So, I mean, you've got that going on. The question will be, I think, when it comes down to it, is first off, we haven't done normal budgeting in a decade or more. Usually these things get rolled up into omnibus bills after doing a few continuing resolutions, and they just roll everything up into one or a handful of omnibus bills and then try to just shove everything into these bills so that people can't really have much time to go through these. This having this component in place makes it a much higher risk that you're going to see the Hyde Amendment disappear in one of those omnibus bills in a way that is going to make it very difficult to stop because there's going to be so much riding on one particular bill. And I think that's a concern that we should also be keeping an eye out for. And again, we're speaking with Michael New of the Charlotte Lozier Institute, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, talking about the Hyde Amendment. I mean, that process is designed to bury things like this. And I suspect that we're going to run into that again this year, even though it's an off year.
No, I agree. I mean, I think that, you know, we just can't fall asleep at the wheel here. I mean, pro-lifers need to be active and engaged as the Senate takes this up. You're right. I mean, my big fear is that they're going to lump a bunch of these bills together. One of the appropriations bills may include something that Joe Manchin strongly supports. They may allow him to cast some kind of a procedural vote against tax-free funding of abortion. But he may circle back and say, you know, I support the Hyde Amendment, but I'd vote for this appropriations bill because it has this program or this benefit for West Virginia, and I just couldn't turn that down. So you're right. The we may not get a straight up or down vote on Hyde or an appropriations bill that contains Hyde. It may be lumped in with several other things. I do expect, you know, Democrats to try to, you know, win this on some procedural maneuver like that. So again, you know, Republicans, you know, need to be savvy about that. And, you know, we as pro-lifers need to be active as well.
And I think it's worth going back to, Michael, to the Obamacare debate, because I don't remember, people remember Bart Stupak. He was a pro-life Democrat. He was one of the few in Congress in 2010. And then Dan Lipinski was the last one, and he lost his election in this past cycle. We've had Dan Lipinski on this show and on Relevant Radio. He appears here occasionally to talk through some of these issues. But Bart Stupak was adamant about making sure that the Hyde Amendment was not just continuing in budget bills, because you have to pass that every single year. It's a rider that has to be passed every single year. But he wanted that to be statutory language as part of the Affordable Care Act, and that's the official name for Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act is the official name of the Obamacare bill. And at the time, this is only 11 years ago, the same people who were in leadership, Nancy Pelosi, then Harry Reid, but Chuck Schumer was part of this too, and Barack Obama assured Bart Stupak that they would never try to block the Hyde Amendment. And that was how they eventually were able to pass the bill in the House, because at that time, Bart Stupak had a small but significant caucus of pro-life Democrats that could have hung the bill up. And that surrender by Stupak, I think, is brought us to where we're at right now, because had he held firm on that and forced the inclusion of that Hyde language in the ACA, first off, I think Republicans would have had a difficult time trying to dismantle it, but also we wouldn't need to be passing this every single year, and that that would require Democrats to try to repeal that language, which they simply don't have the votes to do, especially in the Senate.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, the Democrats were very clever about how they got the Affordable Care Act passed back in 2010. And it looked like there was a contingent of pro-life Democrats that was insisting that the Affordable Care Act had some safeguards that would see to it that taxpayer dollars not pay for abortion. And essentially, Barack Obama offered Bart Stupak an executive order, which almost every pro-life legal analyst agreed was toothless, but it was designed to give Stupak and some others some political cover. Obama signed this executive order that, you know, pledged not to use taxpayer dollars to fund abortion. But again, every pro-life, you know, legal analyst who looked at it agreed that it was toothless and in practice wouldn't stop taxpayer funding for supporting abortion. So again, yeah, we really thought the Stupak was loyal. He betrayed us. It was a disappointment. We were grateful that Dan Lipinski did hold firm. He did cast that vote against the Affordable Care Act, and
he did.
I think he's a real man of principle, and you know, we should applaud him and did applaud him for the vote he cast. But yeah, it just shows that, you know, we need to be, you know, aware of what's happening, and that, you know, the other side is going to have some tricks up their sleeve to try to get an appropriations bill passed that does not include the Hyde Amendment.
Indeed. So you talk about, well, let's go to Pam really quickly. Very quickly, Pam in Nashville, Tennessee. Welcome to the show, Pam. I'm not sure if Pam is ready, actually. We only have about a minute left. So, Pam, I'm just going to go ahead and read this. People only hear or react about abortion during election time, and so it needs to be a frontline issue all the time. I think that's exactly right, Michael, and I think that sometimes we forget that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I always say, no matter who you are, where you live, there's always things you can do to build a culture of life. You can always pray. You can always support your local pregnancy help center. You can always sidewalk counsel. I help run a sidewalk ministry outside the D.C. Planned Parenthood. So there's always things all your listeners can do to build a culture of life. Politics is important, but it's not the only game in town. There's plenty of work to be done.
Indeed. And give us the link to where you're working from and how people can find out more about that.
Sure. I'm the scholar at the Charlotte Lozier Institute. People can look us up online. People can find me on Twitter, Michael_J_New. Michael_J_New. If anyone lives in D.C. and wants to help out with our sidewalk ministry outside the D.C. Planned Parenthood, please get a hold of me. Your prayerful presence is always appreciated. If you'll follow me on Twitter, I'll keep you posted with my writing and research on sanctity of life issues.
Michael New, thank you so much for being with us. And again, the Hyde Amendment, this is going to be a fight that we're going to want to keep an eye on, not just in election years, as our caller said, but every single year. And this is not an election year, so this is the time to do this. When we come back, we'll be talking with Christian Toto, and we'll be talking a little bit about your entertainment choices for this weekend. So be sure to stick around for that. Coming up on the Kel Clark Show, the six sins you didn't realize you were committing, and what Catholics can learn from Simone Biles' Olympic withdrawal. Great show coming up at 5 p.m., so stick around for that. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew. We'll be right back.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
It's 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew today, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. And we are coming up to the weekend here, and as I like to do on Friday afternoons, I like to focus on the entertainment choices that we have as we approach the weekend. And joining us now to do that is my good friend Christian Toto of HollywoodandToto.com. He's a film critic who launched his own website after dealing with the heavily left-wing tendencies of the entertainment media, and he's been operating at HollywoodandToto.com ever since. You can also find him on Twitter at HollywoodandToto. And Christian, welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So many things to discuss, and I have not seen a lot of new material out there. I did watch a new film from Bob Odenkirk that I'm not sure I'd recommend, but it was actually kind of interesting. And, of course, Bob Odenkirk had a heart attack this week on the set of Better Call Saul, and he's recovering, and he's on Twitter earlier today saying that he is doing much better. But it's a film called Nobody. I think it's streaming at Amazon, and I watched it with some friends, and we were sort of half and half on this. If you view this as sort of a hilarious takeoff on John Wick meets Taken, it's very entertaining. If, on the other hand, you're tuning into this just to see a movie, it is so bloody and violent that I think that you're really not going to enjoy this thing. I don't know if you've seen Nobody.
I have, and you know, I think you and I are more in sync with our reviews. I didn't love it. I had some big issues with it. But a lot of people I've spoken to really enjoyed it, and it does have that John Wick feel. And I think one of the creative people behind the scenes, maybe the screenwriter, someone is connected to that franchise. So you kind of know what you're getting into. But I thought, you know, it's a story about a regular guy who kind of lashes out at outlaws, in a sense. And I don't want to, it's kind of a movie you don't want to give away too much, because it really, you've got to have a lot of spoiler-free discussions about it.
Yes, yes.
But I also thought there's a really good movie stuck into this production that they couldn't find. Like, in, you know, he's a good actor. I think some of the arguments they bring up about whether you protect your family, you know, can you be a hero in time of crisis? You know, what does it take to kind of unleash your inner vigilante? All those different things are interesting. But I think they kind of bring it up and then just basically push it all aside for a rock'em sock'em action, which we've kind of seen a million times before.
Yeah, exactly. And it really over-the-top rock'em sock'em action. I mean, really unrealistic rock'em sock'em action. It would be if you had Wally Cox playing the Charles Bronson role in Death Wish, and then you had it played somewhat for laughs, but not entirely. So, I mean, I don't want to get too far into this, because you're right, there's some spoilers here that you probably don't want to give away. The title of which is, it's actually a pretty good title if you manage to make it all the way through this movie. But that's really the only new thing that I've seen in terms of theatrical style movies. Now, I know that you've been writing about this at Hollywood in Toto, and we've talked about it before here. We're going to have to start talking about theatrical style movies, because there's not a whole lot of stuff that's getting into the theaters, and the stuff that is does not seem to be getting a lot of traction. And in part, I think, Christian, that's because the studios are hedging their bets by splitting the distribution between theaters and the and streaming services. And in fact, that's the subject of a lawsuit in one of the most lucrative franchises, maybe the most lucrative franchise over the past 20 years in movies. Tell us a little bit about the lawsuit from Scarlett Johansson.
Yeah, just announced this week she is suing Disney and saying that she's owed more money from them because her movie Black Widow, which was originally intended to be a theatrical release, period, but because of the pandemic, because of the shifting marketplace, they kind of split the difference where you can pay $30 and watch it on Disney Plus or go to the theater like in traditional times. So evidently she's not happy with how much she got paid for this entire experience. And it's getting pretty bitter pretty quickly, because Disney's response back was, you're being callous because we had to kind of shuffle for the pandemic. And I have to say, Disney's a big corporation. I've got lots of issues with that particular company, but they do have a point about that. But, you know, what happens next already, Emma Stone, the Oscar winner, is kind of making noise that she might sue Disney herself, because she was in Cruella, another film that seemed destined for the theaters that also came out on Disney Plus. So it's getting ugly. It's getting messy. And rather than people kind of letting things kind of settle out for themselves, you know, will it be a split model down the road? Will it just go all to streaming? They're lowering up. It's really fascinating to watch. Probably more interesting than actually Black Widow film itself.
Right. Maybe so, because I read some of the reviews for Black Widow. But I will say this. I mean, part of the issue here, in fact, the big issue here for Johansson, and maybe it was for Emma Stone as well, is that they specifically structured the contracts for bonuses based on theatrical ticket sales. And at least that's the allegation from Johansson. I haven't read her contract. I doubt I'd be able to suss out exactly what was going on in those things anyway. And then what she is saying, and of course, these contracts, this was released this year. So this is probably something that was negotiated in 2018, 2017. Nobody knew that all the theaters were going to be closed and that these releases were going to be delayed and that we're going to have still these types of restrictions when they did finally get released. So what she's arguing, and if she's correct about that, what she's arguing is that Disney diluted the ability for her to achieve her bonuses by releasing it on a streaming service for which she wasn't being bonused at all. And my guess is that Stone is going to have a very similar sort of complaint. And so I think you're going to have these situations, especially maybe in this year and next year, where these big movie deals were packaged prior to the pandemic with all of these bonuses and that sort of thing, but are having to be released through alternate methods of distribution, which bypasses the bonuses. I mean, that's a legitimate complaint. If that's really what happened, that's a legitimate complaint. She was, the ability for her to achieve those bonuses was basically taken away from her unilaterally.
I agree. I also think it's interesting that they couldn't come to an agreement, both sides. You know,
right.
There's a lot of money at play. And I also think it reminds us that Cruella really disappointed at the theatrical level, and Black Widow is not a super smash film as well. I mean, listen, we can worry about whose pockets will be lined after all this is said
right.
and done. But I think as an observer of the industry, it's just showing that the movie theater experience is not back. And if they start pushing masks again, I know for myself, I will not go into a theater with a mask unless I've got to do so for work purposes. But, that's not going to help things at all. You want to go into a theater and escape. And if I'm fully vaccinated and feeling comfortable and I still have to wear a mask, I've done it a couple times for work and it's unpleasant. And I don't want to sit in a movie theater and do that. So I think whatever momentum they're trying to get back to get people put into theaters again, I think that will be hurt as well. So lots of different things here. And again, this is, you know, it may sound insider baseball-y, and to an extent it is, but it's also saying what's going to happen in the next 5 years as far as do we still have theaters that are mainstream? Do we just watch everything at home? I mean, that's a big cultural issue.
Well, here's the reason why it matters. And again, we're speaking with Christian Toto of HollywoodandToto.com, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Here's the reason why it matters is because your access to some of these entertainment products may end up being severely limited because of the nature of the way that they're being distributed in virtual space, on the internet through streaming. And it's one thing to have access available to them simply just by purchasing. And you can do that through, say, Amazon, or you can do that through you can't really do purchases through Netflix. Netflix really doesn't have purchasing, or at least they don't have it at the moment. But also through your cable systems. For instance, if you have Xfinity, if you have Spectrum, you can buy the movies, you can buy a ticket to the movie through that. But what's actually where this is drifting, and we see it especially with Disney, is that they're pushing people to their streaming service, Disney Plus, which is a subscription service where you have to be on that particular streaming service to get that movie. And if it was only Disney, that might be worth it. But Paramount will have one. Warner will have one. You're going to have all these things. Of course, HBO has HBO Max, which you have to pay for with a subscription. If you've got cable and you have it on your cable box, you've got access to it already. But the point is that you're starting to see this segmenting to where you're going to have multiple subscriptions in order to access what used to be in the movie theaters a major cultural touchstone. The next Star Wars movie, for instance, will be Disney Plus. It won't be in the theaters where you can wrap the lines around the building and go see it six times with all of your fellow teenage buddies, like I did when I saw it in 1977.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing is a continuation of what happened in the late 90s, is the landscape of pop culture is splintering anew. And, you know, whereas we had these sort of common things that we all rallied around, everyone watched the Seinfeld finale, now we have our own little niches. You know, I like anime, and I like comic book movies, and I like, sophisticated thrillers, and I have these little streaming services that speak to me. So I think we're in a very interesting cultural moment where in 5 years we'll look back and say, oh, that's how that was the beginning of how things changed. And I really do think there's a lot of change afoot. And I also will say about the movies themselves, I have seen a bunch of new films that were in theaters, meant for theaters, and they're not good. Black Widow was disappointing. F9, the Fast and Furious sequel, I thought was a dud. I'm Jungle Cruise, which is out today on Disney Plus and in theaters, I thought was just kind of watered over, just usual stuff, just lots of CGI, lots of effects, and not a lot of heart to it. So I think that's another part of the problem, is that the product is just not as good as it could be. So that's not going to help fill up those seats.
I think, too, that might also be temporary. First off, we're not really in the Oscar-worthy nomination part of the calendar, right, Christian? I mean, this is sort of the time when you're pushing the blockbusters out, the popcorn movies out, and, the fun stuff. And I know that you... You saw Jungle Cruise. We can talk about that in just a moment. That's the new movie based on a Disneyland ride or Disney World ride, depending on which side of the country you're on. But this is sort of the lightweight part of the calendar. Expensive movies usually would draw big audiences because of just the tentpole sort of things. But usually you're not going to run into the really quality films in terms of artwork. Until September, October, November anyway. So it might be a little early to draw that conclusion, right?
Well, I'm very curious to see how sophisticated, mature movies, like you mentioned, the Oscar-bait films, how they fare at the theater now, because I think they've been a tougher sell in the past. You know, the roller coaster rides are kind of easier to kind of pitch. But will audiences, the same audiences that have been watching almost everything at home and streaming, will they all of a sudden go out to theaters to see, Ben Affleck in an Oscar-nominated performance? I don't know. I am skeptical about that. And I think that's going to be an interesting thing to follow. And by the way, one, I think, potential perk of all of this shaking out is that in the past, if you lived in a smaller community, you may not have an art house theater. You might not be able to see a lot of the smaller films, which are often quite good. But I think where we're going to now is that a lot of stuff is going to be available on streaming. So even if you live in a community where there aren't those theaters, you may be able to kind of tap into them via Amazon or via Comcast or via, whatever streaming platform you have.
So tell us a little bit about Jungle Cruise, because, I think that when people are looking for, especially when people are looking for family fare, something you can take everybody to, certainly you're looking at a Disney movie. Certainly one that's based on a Disney World / Disneyland ride might be something that parents will say, well, that might be a good way to go. I would argue that the Pirates of the Caribbean movies were pretty good for that. I'm not sure if the youngest children would be able to keep up with the tension in some of those movies, but for the most part, they would have been seen as not offensive for bringing family along. How does Jungle Cruise match up to your expectations? How does it work for families?
For families, I think the younger audiences will enjoy it more because they'll be more forgiving of its many flaws. So they'll just see, lots of action, some comic routines, two very likable stars, and Emily Blunt and Dwayne Johnson are the main attractions here. But overall, it did feel like a warmed over Pirates of the Caribbean experience where they're taking a Disney attraction, they're turning it into a movie. There's lots and lots of CGI. It's kind of frantic at times. And I will say there's a gay subplot in the movie that is really unnecessary. It doesn't work from a time point of view, because the story is set in 1916. And the way the characters react to the situation, I don't think is really realistic in any fashion. Not that we need realism across the board, but it does seem like an anachronistic moment. It's harmless. It's too long. I think some of the elements are kind of overstuffed. I thought what was a basic story, get the heroes down the Amazon River to find out if this legend is really true. I think they couldn't kind of hold, that wasn't enough for them, so they had to throw in subplots and other characters, and it just gets too busy. So, generally speaking, for an adult, it's a really mixed review for me, even though I found the two leads charming. I think kids will enjoy sort of the busyness of it and some of the kind of cornier aspects. That's my general take.
Well, and there's a strong tradition of corny adventure flicks that are aimed for younger audiences and families. So, I mean, Disney made a lot of those types of things.
Oh, yeah.
In back in the day, you know, when I was a kid, they were making films like that all the time, and not just, you know, in terms of the type of adventure that we're talking about, like, you know, the world's greatest athlete and the computer wore tennis shoes and stuff like that, you know, and if you're an adult watching those things, you're rolling your eyes and saying, yeah, that doesn't work. But if you're a kid, it's like, oh, this is great. This is a lot of fun. So a good popcorn movie for kids, I guess, is what you're saying.
Yeah, and you know, that's a great comparison, but I will say that this is a $200 million production with two of the bigger stars that we have in Hollywood. So I think while those Disney films were sort of lower budget, the expectations were lower, this is really meant to be an event production. And so I think it's hard not to, you know, approach it in that fashion. But you're right, you know, if you're looking for a kind of a lark, you could do far worse than this.
All right, so that's Jungle Cruise. We're going to take a quick break here. When we come back, we're going to talk about other films that Christian might be recommending for you this weekend. I also want to talk a little about his conversation with Gina Davis, one of my favorite actors from a few years ago, and why we may not be seeing so much of Gina Davis these days, and some of the women of similar age. It's a great article by Christian at HollywoodandToto.com. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. We'll be right back.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Your daily dose of faith, hope, and charity. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Past the hour, I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. We're talking with Christian Toto of HollywoodandToto.com for your entertainment choices this weekend. I would just refer you back to HollywoodandToto.com, though, for one particular entertainment choice, which is the piece that you have about Gina Davis and the difficulty she has in finding good, solid roles. And not just herself, but women of her age being able to fit into this. Now, this is not new, Christian. We've heard a lot about this, but it's not improving either, apparently, at least according to Gina Davis.
Yeah, she's been tracking it for a while. Listen, she's in her mid-60s. She has a personal stake in this, but I give her credit. I think she's speaking to her fellow stars who are you know, aged in a way that is normal, natural, and they're not getting as many gigs as the men. You know, we think about older action heroes. Stallone is in his 70s. Liam Neeson, my gosh, I think he just turned or is 69, and he's still doing those movies like he, as if he were, 42 again or even 32. And I think that Hollywood is much more willing to let the men age and be themselves, and it's not necessarily the case with women. And I bring up one example, which I really thought was interesting. You know, I think a lot of us have seen Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure from
yes.
89 or 90 or so, and they made a sequel. And in those films, the two characters fall in love. I think they were with princesses in the original movie.
Medieval princesses,
back and forth.
Medieval
exactly.
princesses.
But in the whole franchise, it turns out that they ended up marrying those women. And in the new movie, Bill and Ted Face the Music, they're in couples therapy. It's a cute little scene about them sort of having their own issues and things like that. It's just part of the comedy. But the actresses weren't the original actresses. So you've got Bill and Ted, those stars who are all in the, they're both in their 50s, Alex Winter and Keanu Reeves. And they look older, but they look like, you know, they always did. You know, we know these actors. We're forgiving of father time. But the actresses playing their spouses, well, they're in their early to mid-40s, and it's not the original cast. So I thought that was a really great example of what Gina Davis is talking about, how women aren't allowed to get older. It's just, you know, listen, there are exceptions. Susan Sarandon works constantly. Frances McDormand just picked up another Oscar. Meryl Streep is ageless. You know, there's certainly women who do defy this principle. But I think in general speaking, it is more true than not, and it's worth talking about.
it is worth talking about. And let's not forget that Gina Davis was actually somebody who did action films back in the day, right? I mean, The Long Kiss Goodnight, it had its flaws, but it was a very good action film.
Yeah, and Cutthroat Island was a big dud, but she acquitted herself, you know, well as another action hero as a pirates movie. But just because it was a bomb doesn't mean that she's not capable as an actress. But then's the rules in Hollywood. And I think what's galling for her, and I understand this, is that Hollywood today is woke, and they're trying to be more progressive, and they're trying to be more inclusive. And, you know, I think there are some good elements of that where more people and of different communities are able to kind of share their stories with the public. I think we get that can often lead to better storytelling and more talented people in the mix. But she's saying, well, if you're going to be progressive and you're going to be woke and you're going to be more evolved, then why aren't you letting older women have more of a say in the conversation? And she makes a good point.
I think she does as well. And again, I was a big fan of Gina Davis, still is a big fan of Gina Davis, and A League of Her Own also comes to mind, you know, a very physical part in A League of Her Own. So one of the best films that she ever did, in fact, A League of Her Own, A League of Their Own, excuse me. all right. So coming into the weekend, we talked a little bit about Jungle Cruise. Are there any good choices out there coming up this weekend for people who are looking for entertainment, looking for a fun or intriguing or thought-provoking experience, either in the theater or in their own home theaters?
You know, it's tough to recommend movies these days, at least the newer ones. I see a lot of clunkers. I don't want to be that guy, that critic who hates every movie. And I don't hate every movie, but I do feel it's been underwhelming in recent weeks. There's a new film that's coming out. It's an indie film. Probably be able to stream it on video on demand, called The Exchange. And I was kind of intrigued by it because it's set in the 80s. I'm kind of an 80s kid. And it's about a kind of a nerdy guy. He's suffering in school, has no friends, and decides to get a foreign exchange student in his house, thinking, well, I'll pick one from France and he'll be cultured and sophisticated. We'll talk about movies. But then the guy he gets is sort of a ladies' man and very, very likable, very charismatic, but they're not a good mix. So it's a comedy. You kind of know what's going to happen next as far as them eventually connecting, but it's not very funny. And it really deals in a heavy-handed way with bigotry and racism, whereas this is a very white Canadian community and the foreign exchange student is both French and of Arab descent. And there's a lot of suspicion, and he's sort of castigated for being of Arab descent. And, you know, I think those themes can be helpful and interesting and kind of add texture to stories sometimes. But this one, it's really heavy-handed, really over the top. And it's one of those, let's stop the movie and give a lecture about how bad it is to judge people based on their appearances. Well, we do know that, and that can be helpful, but just don't you know, slow the movie down to a crawl, letting us know again and again, which is what the movie does. So disappointing, to say the least.
All right, there's another movie that's coming out. It's gotten a lot of advertising attention, Stillwater with Matt Damon. Now, this is a sort of ripped from the headlines drama, and we know it's ripped from the headlines because the woman who was the focus of the headlines is out today, and she is angry about this movie. This is Amanda Knox. This is the woman who was accused of being part of a murder in Italy, and it was locked up for a few years there until finally the case got thrown out, and she is claiming that Stillwater is basically taking her life story and barely fictionalizing it and profiting off of her misery. That is certainly a great springboard, I guess. If there's no such thing as bad publicity, that's a great springboard for this film. What have you heard about Stillwater?
You know, the reviews are good, not great. I have not seen it. I just had a scheduling conflict, so I missed the screening opportunity. The director is Tom McCarthy, and I believe he did the name is escaping me, about the Catholic Church scandal in Boston, Spotlight.
Spotlight, yes,
film,
yes.
And that won the Oscar. So he's a talented fellow. A couple of different notes. Matt Damon has been doing the press rounds about this film and basically saying that I got to meet Trump supporters, and they seem like real nice, normal people, and which is both refreshing and kind of cringeworthy, you know, because are you so bubbled in your Hollywood community you've never met a Trump supporter? I mean, I felt like he meant well, but he kind of landed on deaf ears. But so we'll see. And I do think this movie will be another sign. Well, do we want to go see you know, more mature features at the theater, or is this one we're going to say, it looks okay, but I'll wait till it's on streaming before I check it out. So I think the box office results will be interesting, to say the least.
We got about a minute left. I mean, do you think the controversy here is going to help this out, or do you think that this is going to be something that's going to hobble it a bit here with Amanda Knox sort of going full blast on it?
You know, I think the publicity for that, whether it's good or bad, I think it'll help give it more attention. Because, again, you know, there's a lot of content out there kind of vying for our attention, and this kind of publicity will kind of give it – it'll put it on people's radar where maybe it wasn't before. But, you know, Matt Damon's a good actor. He doesn't open movies. There are very, very few actors today who open movies. It's just not the way the industry works these days. So I think it's got a tough road ahead from the financial point of view. And, you know, hopefully the story is different enough from the Amanda Knox case where, she, you know, other people may not take away those conclusions. But, you know, she would be hypersensitive to any story that overlapped with her life situation in any capacity. So I kind of get it.
Understandably so, too. All right, Christian Toto from HollywoodandToto.com has, as always, wrapped up the entertainment portion of our week so well. Christian, thank you so much for being with us. You can find him also on Twitter at HollywoodandToto, and you can catch up with all of the different reviews and stories from the entertainment industry there. Coming up next, Cale Clark, The Six Sins You Didn't Realize You Were Committing, and What Catholics Can Learn from Simone Biles' Olympic Withdrawal. I can't wait. Stay tuned. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew. Have a blessed weekend.